You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 22, Jerry Ryan's Magic Bag of Cat Suits. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be discussing some Star Trek news, including JJ possibly casting the villain for the next movie, NASA's tractor beam research, a preview of five-year missions year two, plus potato heads and red shirts. In the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt to talk Voyager Scorpion. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Busy week, but always ready to talk Star Trek. I guess we always talk about the weather, and it has been freezing this week. Has it turned to winter yet in Tokyo?
No. Before it can turn to winter, it has to turn to autumn, and I'm not sure that we've had that happen yet.
Oh, wow.
It's been pretty warm recently, unusually warm, and it's supposed to cool down this week, but today was still a bit warm, so I'm hoping for autumn soon because it's my favorite season, and I'm still waiting for the trees to really turn. It's like football season is three-fourths of the way over, and I still, when I go out and walk, I just don't have that autumn feeling, so I'm kind of missing that.
Oh, it's gotten to the point where I'm just annoyed with autumn because like a leaf fell on me today, and I was like, I'm over it. No more leaves. Just, I almost feel... I feel jealous of you for still having warmth around you. And
did you threaten to put that tree in an airlock and
I did.
Vent it out into space if it didn't stop dropping leaves on your head?
I will vent this deck, tree.
I will vent this park. How dare you drop leaves on my head again?
First world problems, I suppose. But anyway.
Well, you know, if you did that, I think that it might make you a villain, at least in the tree world.
Yes.
And that leads us into our first news story this week, which is that J.J. Abrams may allegedly have found his villain for the next Star Trek movie.
Yeah, I understand it's a guy.
It is a guy. Every Star Trek movie needs a guy as a villain, right?
Here's a throwback to one of our earliest episodes, you know,
but
not that long ago.
Hopefully he won't be just a guy, right? Because we don't like the movies where the villain is just a guy.
Right.
If he's going to be a guy, he needs to be a real guy like the old Spice Man.
Right. There we go. I'm not even going to go down that. Okay. Back on track.
We're also planning to have on the show one week.
So this guy is Benicio Del Toro, who's he's been in a lot of stuff. I don't know if he's a big name star yet. He had a huge role in Traffic where we won an Oscar for it. But I think he's still a little bit below the level. So I think he's a really good idea for playing a villain. But obviously, we know nothing so far about what the role will actually be.
Yeah. Honestly, I don't know much about him. I know he's been, like you said, not sure if he's really a big name actor in terms of, like, it's a name that everybody recognizes. Maybe they recognize his characters. He's been, like you said, in some high-profile movies like Sin City and Traffic and like 21 Grams and things like that and Snatch with Brad Pitt. And so but I don't really know that much about him myself. So I think what's interesting to me here, more than it being Del Toro himself, is trying to think of what does this mean in terms of who is the villain going to be?
Right.
If what role? Now, again, I don't know if this is still in play or not, but Orky and Kurtzman had said quite some time back, maybe the beginning of this year, that the next movie would have a familiar villain.
Right.
At the same time, I feel like we've pretty much been promised that it's not Khan.
Yeah, and I guess that's what this... Okay, so Benicio Del Toro is Mexican, and Ricardo Montalban was at least Spanish.
He was Hispanic, right?
Yeah, so, okay, so this is renewing all of that, all those old rumors that we'd sort of thought we'd moved on from.
Yeah.
I don't know
what
this
do you
is
think?
A, I don't know this is a signal that they're going with Khan.
Yeah, me neither.
I mean, if you're going to cast Khan, okay, he's on the list. He's someone you would think of. Although I really think they'd go for someone like, honestly, Naveen Andrews from Lost, who played Saeed, would be a much better choice and more of a bad robot choice. Benicio del Toro is more along the lines of what they did with Eric Bana, where you sort of take a semi-recognizable actor and you just make him whatever the villain is.
Do you think that he might play a Horta?
It's possible. It's always possible. No, I was...
Horta was one of those, you know, when the villain possible villains were being thrown out, Horta was one of those.
Well, I think we can rule out the Horta. I think we can rule out Henry Mudd at this point.
You mean Harry Mudd?
What is my problem with saying Henry? I think it's because I don't like Mudd as a character. I don't like either of the Mudd episodes.
You pulled that out of Henry Mudd's Magic Bag of Hindsight.
I did. Right? These are jokes that you will understand later. Anyway,
or if you've listened to past shows as well.
Right. I think...
I don't think it's not going to be Mudd.
Right.
This casting is definitely not for Mudd.
If anything...
Unless Mudd is like a completely different kind of character in this timeline.
It's true. It's possible.
Which is possible, you know.
What I think this signals is that they're going for a serious villain. Just someone who is going to be the equal of Kirk and probably a captain. I think that's what this feels like to me.
Okay, here's another question. Do you think it's possible... Now, another villain that has been thrown out were the Talosians themselves from the cage, mm-hmm. which we saw again in the Menagerie. And we're going to talk a little bit later in the news. We'll talk about Star Trek comics a little bit. But, you know, they're going through these stories again in the comics from the original mm-hmm. series. Do you think that the Talosians could be the villains and that he's going to play a Talosian character who we didn't see in the original series? Kind of like in First Contact, we had the Borg Queen, who we had never seen before. And I'm not trying to be silly and say he's going to be like a Talosian king or something, but just maybe he is a Talosian villain that we haven't seen, and maybe the Talosians are the background.
We've only seen like the nice parts of Talos. You know, maybe he's from South Talos, and he's actually a corrupt cop who is trying to... I mean, he's good-hearted, but he's trying to keep the drugs from passing through to North Talos.
North Talos, yeah.
Yes.
Now, would those be the drugs that they used to make Captain Pike have all those hallucinations?
Those are those drugs, actually. They're used for the experiments, but they're also, I mean, on the street, they're worth quite a bit of cash.
Oh, yeah, because there are a lot of streets on Talos 4, as we saw when the landing party being
Well, we haven't seen urban Talos.
Oh, yeah, we haven't seen urban Talos yet. Yeah, we got to go to Talos City. I mean, that's where all the action happens.
Oh, my goodness.
So is this movie, then, are we thinking this going to be like a heavy-handed anti-drug message, like Symbiosis in The Next Generation?
It's very possible. I mean, I do hear that they're getting Denise Crosby to come on and tell the audience, you know, drugs feel good.
It's right.
They really do. They feel amazing. You have no idea how awesome drugs are, Wesley. Do you remember this episode? It was early, obviously, season one.
And that's Yar telling Wesley this.
That's Yar telling Wesley how amazing drugs feel. I guess she goes on to explain that later they don't feel so good. But I don't really think that message got through to Wesley or the
viewers. More you know, right?
Right.
Did they play? They had the peacock and the rainbow, and they played.
They did. Well, it was. You know how they do the keyboard with the bam 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 bam. Then they did bam 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 for the more you know. Yeah,
I see. I think I missed that part. All right. Well, I don't know what this means for the next
I don't know
movie.
What this means.
I really don't know.
It means that they're making progress. It means they're casting. That's
a
good sign.
It means they probably have a script now.
Probably. Yeah, that might be a stretch, but I think they might at least have an outline that they figured out.
They have a 130-page outline now.
Right.
It's double-spaced.
It's good. Okay. It's good. I don't think he'll be playing Cybok. I don't think he'll be playing whatever Mudd's first name is. I don't think he'll be playing Khan.
So Harvey Mudd.
Harvey Mudd. I think I'm gonna say this for future reference. I think he'll be playing a brand new character we've never heard of before. I think they're going to be charting a new course with this movie.
I think you might be right, actually. It's kind of the feeling I have too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're saying now production is supposed to start in early 2012, I don't know if that's like what we think of as early or if it's like what Apple thinks of as early, which would be March 31st of 2012. Right. I don't know what that
Microsoft.
Means.
Well, there's Microsoft. I think Microsoft just did Q3 2014 or something. Wacky calendar over at Microsoft.
Well, if they said that, if whatever they're releasing, it's going to be out in like 2026. So,
right.
Anyway, we'll just have to see where this is leading because I really don't know. But it is exciting to hear that.
Yeah,
there's some forward progress being made. I really don't expect to see this movie before probably summer of 2013. Would you say?
That's what I've basically consigned myself to. I mean, I don't think Christmas releases are good for Star Trek. I really don't. I guess Star Trek 4 did really good around Christmas time, or at least not a summer release.
Yeah.
But I think in general, it's not a good idea. And as we've talked about, The Hobbit coming out, both Hobbits, I just don't think it's a good idea to hit either Christmas 2012 or 2013. So that summer 2013 sounds like a good point.
Yeah, unless the hobbits are the villains in this movie.
Goodness.
I
don't know.
Think how much money they could make if they combined these two movies. Like if they had a starship in The Hobbit and they had hobbits as the villains in the Star Trek movie and they could cross promote.
What happens is a probe shows up and is looking for the Ents. And
oh god, it's a giant tree in space, and like the branches are sticking out everywhere,
and leaves
start falling all over the earth, and Greg gets all pissed off.
It really pisses me off. And Kirk and Spock have to go back to Middle Earth and talk to Treebeard, and it takes 6 months, but they bring an Ent back, and it talks
to the probe. Oh man, we
worst
just hit
crossover
box office
fan fiction ever
right here. Oh gosh! All right. Well, you know, why don't we move on to the next story?
Please do.
Because if they cannot succeed in getting an Ent from Middle Earth, they're going to have to get rid of that probe somehow, and for that, they're going to need tractor beams, I think, to tow it away. And luckily for them, NASA is currently funding development of laser tractor beams, which could maybe eventually, of course, with everything this has been reported in the news, as NASA is working on Star Trek tractor beams. I think these are a far cry from what we're accustomed to in Star Trek, but they're throwing some money at it.
Yeah, I don't know how long we can spend on this, but it's more research. You know, we always talk about how research is being driven by Star Trek, and you know, this is a really powerful idea of the idea that you could touch something without physically touching it. The idea you could, especially in space, reach out and grab something without needing, you know, like the space grappling hook that Enterprise has.
Or
in
a
the
giant
first season.
Hand. The hand of Apollo.
Apollo.
I don't think NASA's working on that, though.
Probably not. So something, I don't know, I'm not understanding how a laser tractor beam works. I know that Picard was not worried about lasers at all in the episode, it was actually quite hilarious
that they were locking lasers on the ship.
Well, I mean,
right?
What if those had been laser tractor beams and they could have wiggled the Enterprise back and forth?
The people falling from one side to the other over and over. Yeah, that would have been great. Yeah, I don't know either here. Yeah, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. I did just want to mention that it's something that NASA is working on, you know, because we've talked about different technologies recently. I think the trick here is doing it in space, really. Right. I don't really have any doubt that they can figure out how to create some sort of tractor beam using lasers and use it here. But doing it in space where there's no air, of course, is a different challenge.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. They have three types that they're working on right now. They have one which they know actually does work. It's kind of like an optical tweezers. I think I saw them refer to it as using light to overlap and create like a ring that traps particles, and then they can use that to move things.
Yeah.
And then you go on down. There's one type called a bezel beam.
Right.
That they haven't really tried before. It's kind of a new concept, so they don't know if that's going to work or not.
Yeah. I mean, it's not so much like a tractor beam. It's more like a space lasso. You sort of that's create a ring around what you're trying to pull, and it somehow traps it inside, which is a cool concept. Yeah. It's something I didn't really... Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's kind of hard to imagine a beam you shoot at something and it sticks like glue.
Right.
The idea of grabbing it with a ring is a really interesting idea, something that actually kind of makes sense.
And having a space lasso like that would be great in the future because... You know, Kirk likes to practice that cowboy diplomacy.
Uh-huh, yep.
So this will be perfect for him. Yep. Plus the visual effects they could do of actually lassoing another ship
would definitely
be pretty awesome as well.
Well, it'll be very helpful when the probe that's looking for the cow shows up and they realize that the cows no longer exist on 2030. I don't like Star Trek 4. I'm sorry.
That's the one. That's where all the milk starts shooting up out of the dairy fields into the sky. And causes a milky film to surround the planet and block out the sunlight.
That's a better plot.
Another of the lost plots from Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Oh, goodness.
But yeah, I think that's why I said this is not exactly how news reports it as Star Trek tractor beam.
Right.
Because what we think of is this beam that spreads out from the ship, you know, like a green or a blue beam or something that envelops the other ship completely. And holds it there. And that's something technologically which I think is very far away. And not really even all that related to what this is. This is more like towing and grabbing an object. Like you said, lassoing it, maybe pulling it toward you a bit. But they're not going to, you know, push an asteroid out of the path of a planet like they do in The Next Generation with something like this.
But the tweezers sound interesting too. I mean... we were watching Scorpion this week, and the doctor goes in and does surgery on a nanoprobe. And I was thinking, how is he going to do that? But if they're working on tools like this for manipulating tiny objects, that's really fantastic.
Well, you know, if they had something like this in the 90s, when George Costanza hits the squirrel, and they take the squirrel in to the vet, and the vet has to send off for some very small tools... It would have been so easy. And then George probably wouldn't have lost a girlfriend over that stuff either. But
he probably wouldn't. I totally
agree.
Did
he hit a squirrel or a pigeon? I don't even remember now. We have a deal with the pigeons. So anyway, he hit a small animal.
Right.
A squirrel.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, we have a video of this on the website.
Check it out.
If you go and check the news section, it's a video that NASA did showing how these things work, what they're trying to develop. It's kind of interesting if you want to know what they're doing right now and how it operates. And eventually, you know, this stuff might get us towards the tractor beams that we know in the future. Well, Greg, I want to move on to the next story, but do you hear something?
Oh, wow. That. That sounds like 5-year mission.
But how can that be? Is there a new album coming out?
I think there might be. I think I've heard something about that. Obviously, we've heard Year One. It's one of my favorite albums of all time, covering the first, I don't know, 15 or so episodes of the original series. But Year Two, I do hear, is coming this December. And I think we have something very special in the Trek FM offices, do we not?
We actually do, and I'm really excited about this, Greg. We have a pre-release copy of Year Two, which I've been listening to over and over for the past few days, and really loving the album.
Yeah. I got a copy, I guess it was Friday, or Saturday, actually, and I listened to as much of it as I could. I'm about halfway through. I'm loving it. You know, it's one of those sophomore albums where the production has improved. It's not that there was anything wrong with Year One, but this sounds like so such more of a complete album where they spend a lot of time figuring out complex arrangements and really interesting lyric styles. And I'm really impressed by Year Two. I can't wait for everyone else to be able to hear it as well.
Yeah, same here. I think what you're describing, this album has a lot more variation and style on it than Year One did.
Yeah.
Year One, also a fantastic album, which I still listen to all the time, which is why I was so glad to get Year Two, because I've listened to Year One.
Yeah.
So much. I mean, my Last FM playlist, 5-Year Mission, I think they're like fourth.
Oh, wow.
Overall, in all my artists, because I've listened to Year One so many times.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so much improvement that it's almost as if, I mean, I saw a picture of Mike Rittenhouse recently. He actually grew a beard, shaved his head, and changed his wig between Year One and Year Two.
I saw that picture too. I've been trying to get Mike to use that as his avatar, actually, on Twitter. I also said that you should have made that the album cover, but they wanted
really
to stick, you know, they wanted to have the consistent theme.
Oh, sure.
So hopefully in the actual physical CD edition, when you open up the booklet, that's the first thing that you'll see there.
I hope it is.
Is a Mike with a beard, a shaved head, and a wig on.
So. And the new wig.
All right. But yeah, improvement's not really the word I would use here, because
no.
It's not like it's still very consistent from Year One, but the style, the variation in styles is so much more noticeable on here.
Yeah.
And so let me ask you, I've listened to the album straight through about 5 or 6 times already. Now I have a favorite currently, which is very late in the album.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had a chance yet? Have you gotten to Who Mourns for Adonais?
Well, that's the penultimate track. I mean, I guess, no, I've actually not gotten that far. I'm trying to remember how far I've gotten. I think Space Seed is the last one I've heard, which is the one they actually played on our show a few months back at this point.
Yeah, a few months back, acoustic. Go back and check that out. Look back through the Radio Room archives if you want to hear them play that acoustic. I'll try to put a link to it in the show notes of this one. It's just, wow. I mean, here when you talk about growth, artistically, what they do with Who Mourns for Adonais, for me, anyways, creative person, it's just really brilliant. I absolutely love it. It's lines from all different episodes being spoken over music, and it alternates from the left speaker to the right speaker and back and forth. It's almost like you're in the middle of this slingshot around the sun in Star Trek IV, and you got that kind of drug-induced sequence going on with all the styrofoam heads popping up out of the fog or
goodness.
Something. It kind of has a little bit of that kind of unusual feeling to it. It's great. I mean, after we record this, go listen to it.
Okay, I'll have to do that.
But for today, why don't we play a couple of clips from the album here? Let people hear just a couple little snippets to whet your appetite for the new album.
Yeah.
And let's just start off with the very first song on the album, which is the Galileo 7.
And Chris, I really love this one. You know, we'll be talking a little bit later in the show about the ongoing Star Trek comic, and the next one they're getting to is Galileo 7. And this is a really strong episode of Star Trek, and I think it's a great, great one to start off the show. Obviously, any show that can rhyme Rock and Spock gets, you know, A++ in my book.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a great track to start off the album with, and this is one of the more, you know, with 5-Year Mission, you get two types of songs usually. You get kind of the straightforward telling story song, and then you get where they pick up a thread in the episode that's maybe a minor element, or they tell it from someone else's perspective, for example, like in Balance of Terror, where they focus on the wedding that didn't happen.
That's great.
So here in Galileo 7, it's a bit more of telling the story and about how that's kind of Spock's first big command moment for him having having the lives of the crew of the shuttle.
But I think more than just showing the events of the episode, I think it pulled the emotional core of the episode and really put it in song form. You know, they always say in musicals, you know, when the emotion becomes too great to speak, they sing. And this is a great example of that, where this is the emotion of the episode coming out, and it's, which is crazy to say because a lot of it is on Spock and the troubles he's having, you know, yeah. with having to lead this group and try to figure out what to do to get off the rock again.
Yeah.
The Rhino.
Yeah, I agree. But hearing it this way, it does put more of your focus on that element of that episode
yeah.
rather than the gigantic guys with the huge spears,
right.
you know, that they're
right.
kind of weird stuff going on.
Right.
Well, the second track on the album is The Squire of Gothos. And I have to admit that the first time this played, I sent a tweet to Mike and I told him, I'm up dancing around the studio to The Squire of Gothos. And nice. To show why, let's play a little clip of this one.
Yeah, Chris, you know, as I was saying before we started recording, you know, Squire of Gothos. It's a great, I mean, just like Space Seed has this great hook to it. Squire of Gothos has it too. And, you know, we've talked about Trelane before, and he's a great character. And I love this song. I mean, it's not my favorite of the, I guess I've listened about half the album so far. It's not my favorite of them so far, but it does have that great hook. It treats Trelane, you know, exactly as he should be treated. And it's such a great episode that I don't think people give credit to. And it's good to see it given, you know, this sort of humorous take. I love the humorous Five-Year Mission yeah. songs as much as I like the emotional ones.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. Because, you know, in The Next Generation, we think of Q as being humorous a lot of the mm-hmm. time. And I'm sure you're aware that later on in a series of books by, I want to say, Greg Cox called Q, The Q Continuum, mm-hmm. they actually do portray Trelane as a Q. Because yep. there's been a lot of speculation, like, oh, maybe Trelane was a Q. And there's a lot of that kind of playfulness in this episode, too, because, yeah. you know, we do find out that Trelane is a child, basically.
Yeah.
At the end. So this song, I do also love the playfulness of this song.
Yeah, pointing out the salt vampire statue guarding
I love that,
his,
yeah. I've got a salt vampire statue by my door. That's a great line. There's so many great lines like that in this album, too. All right. Well, next week we'll talk about a couple more tracks, and we're going to talk about a few tracks each show up until the release, which is coming up in December.
Yeah.
And you can already go to fiveyearmission.net and you can pre-order the album.
Right.
I think it's $10 and and you'll have your, as soon as it's released, you'll have your copy in hand.
Yeah. And don't think we're getting free copies. You know, we both paid for year two. We were planning on paying and we went ahead and paid. And the only deal we got was early copies, but
that's right.
Definitely go out there and support Five-Year Mission because they put an awful lot of effort into this album
and also
go see them live. They're going to start touring to promote this album, and it's definitely going to be worth seeing their show because from what I understand, they have just as much fun up there on stage as they have recording the album.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Anybody listening who doesn't know us that well, this is not any kind of paid advertisement or anything like that. We really love Five-Year Mission, which is why we bought copies and were able to get them early so that we could share and preview with, because we really do love these guys.
Yeah.
All right, Greg. Moving on, one really quick thing. We don't really need to talk about the documentary itself here, but we did just want to make sure everyone knows that if you are a Netflix customer and you have Netflix Instant Streaming, William Shatner's documentary, The Captain, is now available to you.
Yeah, and I noticed this. I didn't see the news story before. I was just on my Netflix on my PS3, and whoa, there it is. So they're doing a good job of promoting it, too. You know, probably because I watched so much Star Trek, they put it at the front for me. But I'm sure if you're a Star Trek fan and you have Netflix Instant Streaming, you've seen that The Captain's is on there. It is worth the watch. I mean, we had an episode, I'm trying to remember, a couple months back,
where we
did talk about The Captain's, and a couple of us on the show had seen it at that time, and you've seen it since.
I have it. I was able to get it through iTunes,
right.
And I've started watching it. I didn't get all the way through it yet. Okay. I got pulled away, but what I've seen so far, I love it. What I love about it too is that it's really not like, it's about the actors, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, here's another behind the scenes of Star Trek kind of thing. You know, it's really getting to hear about these actors firsthand and how they got into acting and what led them to Star Trek. So definitely go watch it if you haven't seen it. It's
yeah,
definitely worth a watch for sure.
It's great to see. I mean, just man, the stuff with Kate Mulgrew is just fantastic, about being a mother and a Star Trek actor. The stuff with Avery Brooks, where I'm going to again kindly say that he's insane. And yeah, even the stuff with Patrick was really good. And my favorite, I don't know, my favorite part of the documentary is where he talks to Chris Pine, you know, the young Kirk, and really just gets a lot of it out there and tries to, I think Shatner was really trying to dig into this guy and figure out, you know, can this guy play a young me? Like, is he worthy? Does he have the Shat inside of him?
What it takes to be the Shat, yeah.
And I think Chris Pine really, really comes off very well in the documentary. You know, you might just think he's just this young, cocky actor who got hired, but I think he really has the chops to be a real member of the Star Trek family.
Well, we'll find out for sure when J.J. Abrams reboots T.J. Hooker and when they cast Chris Pine as T.J. Hooker. That's when we'll know for sure. Also, well, the first time that Chris Pine sings Rocket Man.
That was going to be my... Yeah. Oh. Okay, there we go.
Sorry. It was just too easy.
It is too easy. I can't wait to hear Chris Pine's first musical album. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. And Zachary Quinto will be doing Frodo. As soon as The Hobbit comes out, he'll be singing a song about the Frodo and the Bilbo Baggins.
Greg, have we ever had this conversation on here before? I'm either having incredible deja vu or we have had this exact conversation about Rocket Man and Frodo before.
Have we really? I don't remember.
I don't know.
Saying that Zach Quinto is going to sing Bilbo, the Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
I don't know.
It's possible.
Boy, you never know. All right.
Oh, dear. Well, something we certainly haven't talked about before is Star Trek potato heads, which are coming out soon from the PPW toy company. I had no idea this was coming, but apparently it's coming out quite soon, Chris.
Well, I mean, it takes a while for potatoes to grow. I mean, but this product has been under development, underground, since the spring.
And NASA researchers have been hard at work. When they're not working on the tractor beam, they're working on the Star Trek potato heads.
Well, I think the two go hand in hand. They've been developing the tractor beams to find a way to get the potato heads out of the ground so that they can actually get them to market. Apparently, Entertainment Earth has been asking them, when are we going to get these things to sell? And they said, well, we're working on it. Yes, there are two sets coming out. There's Kirk and Core, and that's available right now. And then there's Spock and Uhura, which I think comes with hugging action.
Oh, and I was going to get them and just go...
I think so. I noticed that the Uhura potato head is wearing red lipstick, and I think there's actually a stick of lipstick that comes in the set, because as you have Kirk and Spock potato head hugging and kissing, while Kirk and Kor stand over on the corner of your desk watching and going, you know, they would have never done this in the prime timeline.
I think you just said that Kirk and Spock were kissing.
Did I?
And that's in our After Dark episode, Chris.
I
believe you meant Kirk and Spock. Kirk and Uhura? Kor and Spock. Kor and Spock were kissing on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Really? I think I missed that scene, too. You know, I've really got to stop browsing Google.
You really do.
I really have to stop. I mean these Google image searches.
You do. You type in do a barrel roll. And it spins around, and then you don't know where you're at. Suddenly you're Googling, you know, Kirk and Core in a bathtub, and you don't know what's going on.
Oh, you're right. That's what happened to me. I had Spock and Uhura, and then Google spun me around, and I'm all screwed up now. So anyway, I think it's Kirk and Core over on the corner of your desk, and you play all day with your Spock and Uhura potato heads, which will be released later this month in November, with the accessory lipstick that you're going to have to put back on because it keeps rubbing off on Spock. So, oh my goodness.
This may
See
be the
what
silliest
the Abrams
episode.
Verse has done to
this may be the
classic.
The silliest Ready Room. And people haven't even heard the feature yet, and it's already the silliest Ready Room we've ever had.
That's right. Yeah, we recorded the feature before the news this week.
Yes.
All right. Well, get your potato heads anyway. Yes. Go to the website. We'll have some information there. You can order them from Entertainment Earth. Kirk and Core are currently available already and may include a glomer, possibly, and a special packaging. I don't know about that. And in November, you can get the Spock and Uhura. So, Greg, have you ever wanted to be a red shirt?
Wow, that's a tough question. I mean, sometimes when I'm feeling really down and I'm just, you know, there's not much good in my life. And I just feel like, you know, the best way to just end it all would be for Kirk to send me on a hopeless mission on some destitute alien planet and get vaporized in 2 seconds and then never get spoken of again.
Well, but or you really could be resurrected in the next episode.
That can't happen.
Yeah. and then everything would be better because, you know, you can have a new life.
I can die multiple times. Yes. And one of the great things about the Star Trek ongoing comic is the resurrection of the red shirt. You know, one thing I don't want to say I hated anything about TNG, but I don't like that they changed the colors. You know, it's...
Yeah.
Red's now command. You know, you can't just kill off a command person anytime you feel like it. Let's get back to the good old days. The good old days of TOS where you put on a red shirt, you're probably going to die in the next 5 minutes.
Right. Unless your name is Scotty or Uhura.
Oh, yeah. Right. Exactly.
Or, yeah. So if you want to be a red shirt anyway, you're going to get an opportunity because IDW, the comic publisher, they have joined forces with CBS Consumer Products and the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund to run a contest in which you and your local comic retailer can appear on the cover of an upcoming issue of the comic as a red. Well, you're a red shirt, and we have a sample on the website. We have a sample of the cover. You're a red shirt, and your comic retailer is wearing gold in the background, and you're protecting your comic.
Oh, they don't mean my local comic retailer, like the comic book store itself. I was imagining a comic book probe comes to Earth looking for comic books, and they have
and
to
all
travel
the comic
back
books
in time.
Go flying up in the air.
They have to travel back in time to a comic book retailer so they can bring a comic book back to the 23rd century.
You know the old song, "The Land of a Thousand Dances." This episode of The Ready Room is the land of a thousand rejected Star Trek IV plots.
Oh my goodness. But no, this is very exciting. I'm kind of iffy on the covers of Star Trek so far. The alternate covers seem to be fantastic.
Yeah, the alternate.
But it looks like this is an interesting idea where they're going to put fans on the cover for at least one of the covers. And it's a really cool idea.
One. Yeah.
Right. Well, I don't know if it's going to be the main cover or the
Or a special cover. It's a special cover. They're actually only going to print 300 of these, I believe. And the winner gets 100, and the fan's retailer, the human being inside the shop, gets 100.
The friendly neighborhood man selling
the
comic
and
books.
And the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund gets 100, which I suppose they can sell as special covers maybe to raise money.
Well, so this is the point. It's a charity for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, which This is like a big deal. It's a good charity. I'm all for it. They're trying to defend comic retailers, and anything we can do to help them, sure. I'm all for it. And this is a fun little thing they can do. Penny Arcade does the same sort of thing for Child's Play, their children's hospital charity, where every year they'll auction off an appearance in their comic. And, you know, it's a great way to get people involved because, you know, everybody wants to be involved in their favorite property.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great idea. If you want to enter this, again, we'll have some information on this in the show notes and on the website. But it's very easy to enter. You just send an email to contest@idwpublishing.com with the subject line, "Save My Retailer." And then in 300 words or less, and I do recommend not taking less too literally, like 5-6 words probably isn't going to get you on the cover. So minimalism is not necessarily the best approach here.
300 words, I'll do it in 5.
Yeah, 5, yeah. That's right, 5. Oh, you think I can do it in 5? I'll do it in 3. Save My Retailer. How do you like that?
There you go.
I don't even need a body. No. It's just my subject line. Okay. All right. We're channeling pre-Captain Kirk here, right?
Yes, we are.
All right. So anyway, send the email, 300 words or less, explain why your local comic retailer is the best.
Yes.
And you may be able to get on the cover. And while we're talking about channeling pre-Captain Kirk here, I think both of us, Greg, we both have the second issue of Star Trek ongoing.
Finally,
which
yes.
concludes yeah. the story of Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of that pre-Captain Kirk in there near the end. So tell me what you think about how they wrapped up the story without having Daner.
Yeah, well, okay. To be honest, I'm not the hugest fan of the episode Where No Man Has Gone Before. And I think part of this is because of the Daner character. She started talking about Esper abilities, and that's not really something that comes up in Star Trek. I much prefer the what happens to Mitchell just be a mystery. Like, we're not really sure why he's being affected in this way, but it's simply a fact that Mitchell's being affected. It's dangerous. What are we going to do? So, I mean, as much as there's that whole Make Me Daner campaign out there, I'm not sure that Daner's necessary for this plot, and it's really interesting to see her gone. And I guess what we talked about last time we spoke about ongoing was that issue one was very much just a retread of the first half of the first episode.
Fairly much, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not 100%, but
yeah, I mean,
they played it pretty straight.
Yeah, I mean, it's on the new set, and there's that little bit where Spock, you know, goes over and is like, Miota, are you okay? And, you know, little things. Okay, Daner wasn't there. They had the whole thing where because Bones was there.
I thought you
Daner
said Yoda, there. Are you okay?
Yoda, are you okay?
Yes, I'm fine.
Oh, goodness. Yoda.
Yoda. If Spock and Yoda start kissing in the next Star Trek movie, I'm just going to have to... I don't know.
Well, just like when Yoda fights, he jumps around a lot. Yoda's very kinetic in his kissing as well.
Gosh.
Anywho, so ongoing number two is where they really had their chance to show this is how things are going to be different now.
Yeah, right.
And it's really great. I mean, just from the first page, it starts being different. I feel like, I don't know if it's the first page, but... instead of just seeing a matte painting of the Delta Vega station, they go into the Delta Vega station, you know, onto these sets that I don't think they could have afforded in the 60s. And I think that's my main thought about this whole comic is they could not have afforded this in the 60s.
They couldn't have drawn those sets in the 60s?
Well, they couldn't have built
them. It's a comic,
them.
Right? I'm just kidding.
Right. You know what I'm saying? That this is like if the original series had had like a feature film budget, it would have looked like this.
Yeah, you get to see more into the action, yeah. I guess this way you mean.
And I guess that's what I really felt like. I'd like to talk to you about the actual conclusion, how it ends. But I was really, I guess it's weird to be impressed by the production values. But as I've spoken about before, I like the visuals of Star Trek. And I thought this really felt like... it didn't feel like they were on sets, which is great. And it didn't feel like it was very generic. It felt like here's these interesting characters that we've been introduced to in this movie trying to figure out their way through this story. And unlike maybe the people we saw in the in the TV show, these characters aren't ready for this sort of mission. Kirk is not ready at all. He has no idea what to do. Which is really interesting and makes me wonder if that is really the direction they're going in the next movie. I mean, are we really going to see Kirk really just not have any idea what to do?
I don't think so. I think they're going to jump ahead in time.
Yeah, probably. Probably. Yeah. But at any rate, it's interesting to see it here where he's kind of powerless. And eventually he just has to go out and say, I really hope I can kill my friend because that's the only thing I can do. If I can shoot him and he'll die...
You do have that, and you have him like begging and begging, and you, it was not like Shatner's Kirk,
no,
the way they played it here, yeah.
Well, what were your thoughts overall?
I don't know. I was, it was fine, I guess. It was fine. I don't know what I was hoping for or expecting. Hmm. I like the fact that there's some tie-in to what we saw in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Abrams' first movie, you know, of Mitchell giving Kirk this, you know, vision of the bar where Pike comes in and, you know, Kirk's sprawled over the table after the mm-hmm. fight and all. They had some tie-in there. Cool. So you do get the feeling that, well, these are the characters from the alternate yeah. timeline. Yeah. We're not just replaying the other one. I guess the letdown point for me was just how it just ended. It was just like, oh, I mean, God, I don't want to give away too much of what happens here at the
yeah,
end.
Yeah, it's true.
But, you know, it just felt like it was kind of a sudden ending that I was hoping for something a little bit different, a little bit more build up, or a little bit more excitement to the resolution maybe than what I got. But I don't know. I mean, don't listen to me on it. I'm first of all, I'm not a huge comic book guy in the first place.
Right.
I'm reading these because I'm interested to see where they're going and how they're leading towards the next movie, because they say it has a direct tie into the next movie.
Right.
I do think they're really well drawn. I think they're very well done comics. The characters, as we said last time, they do sound like themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The voice is good. I think it's definitely worth reading. You know, go if you like comics, absolutely. If
yeah.
you kind of like comics and you're a big Star Trek fan, pick it up or get it digital through the IDW Comics app that you can get on iPhone or iPad. Which I don't know if they have that app for Android or not, but they have for iOS
anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And check them out. They are fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we don't have any Star Trek on TV. We have the movie that came out, and there are fans of this new movie. And if you liked the new movie and that's like what you're thinking of as Star Trek, I would almost read this instead of going back to the original series. You know, crazily enough, this feels like a continuation more than just going back to old stuff.
If you don't know the original series.
If you don't know the original series, this is a great way to get into it.
Continue
especially
the story that J.J. Abrams has started.
Right. It's going to be a great present, a great gift, I should say. Like when the next movie's coming out, to give this like as a graphic novel to someone who saw the first movie and really liked it, but isn't going to go back and watch the original series. But I can give them this and give them more of a taste of what Star Trek is like, the sort of stories it tells, without having to, I don't want to say subject, but, you know, you show
I think
someone.
We just lost a few listeners here, Greg.
We did. But the sets and there's things that aren't what Star Trek is today.
It's not what people are used to today.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think if you grew up with the original series, or if you are of the age where you watched the original series in reruns before there was any Next Generation, then for you, Star Trek is the original series. And I'm one of those people. I mean, I was almost out of high school when TNG came around. So I'm TOS person. And
right.
But it's one reason why I know a lot of purists complain about the remastered project and they hate the TOS remastered stuff. But I will still go back and watch the original versions. But what I love about the remastered is that it makes the original series a little bit more accessible to the modern audience, which I think is really important, because there are really, really good stories in the original series.
Yeah.
They're really well written. There is a lot of, I mean, there's Spock's brain, of course, but there are a lot of really great stories in the original series, but the stories are kind of inaccessible to the modern audience, people who have never seen it before, because they just see it as cheesy effects and cheesy props.
Right.
So I get what you're saying in that respect, for sure.
Okay. I don't want to lose viewers, but this is sort of like remastered plus.
Is this like the American Express Plum card where we like we ran out of things and now it's here's something better than titanium? It's a plum. They're really delicious, you know, and you should get one.
The American Express Sphere. It's I don't know. Like I said, this isn't an episode that I love of the original series, but I really like what they did with it here. And it feels like a good exploration of the concept that they were going for without having to stumble over some of the limitations that the show was at that point in time.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that for sure. Okay.
So I definitely think if you're a Star Trek fan, I would pick this up. It's some of the Star Trek comics in the past have been forgettable, you know, just
yeah.
little offshoots here or there, you know, like the Tribbles and
This is definitely better done than a lot of the Star Trek comics that have come out over the decades for sure.
It feels to me like this is where the money's being spent. We sort of talked last week about how they're not producing the novels like they used to. And this feels like where they're really putting their focus, at least in these issues. I can see the money being spent. There's nothing wrong with them visually. I don't think there's anything wrong with the scripts. The only complaint you're going to have is if you're just not that into comics, you're not going to care for it, I suppose.
Yeah. But I would say even if you're not into comics, they're still worth a look. Well, just as every Star Trek series before it, at least in the modern era, went through kind of a period of reboot, The Next Generation with The Best of Both Worlds, DS9 with Way of the Warrior, Voyager kind of did the same at the end of the third season with Scorpion. And today we'll talk about Scorpion, and of course I have Greg here with me, and also joining us today we have Charlene Schmidt, the new Voyager editor for Trek FM. Hi, Charlene.
Hey, yo. How's it going?
Welcome, welcome.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. All right, guys. So we're going to talk a little bit about the scorpion and the frog today, I think it is.
Oh, Chakotay.
It's whatever animal he wants to make up at the time.
All right. It's the scorpion and the tattooed fox.
The scorpion and the Siamese cat.
Right.
Scorpion and the llama.
Scorpion and the hawk.
Blue llama.
Which is especially interesting. I like the scorpion and the hawk one because the scorpion gets to fly, which, you know,
normally
doesn't
happen. Well, that would be
a great
illusion. To the Da Vinci thing, too, because they're talking about that a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Like the flying machine,
definitely.
Right?
Oh, you modeled your flying machine. I see that you modeled your flying machine after a hawk carrying a scorpion.
There you go. See?
Perfect.
Now that's storytelling.
All right. All right. Well, before we kind of jump into Scorpion itself here, why don't we talk a little bit about Voyager up to this point? Because, as I said, this is, again, kind of the turning point of a series, which always happens like after season 3, which in the case of Enterprise, you know, we lost the series. I mean, they were fighting for survival when you would think the studio would know season 3 right. is where we find our legs. But anyway, within Voyager, so let's say, Greg, what were your thoughts about Voyager from the beginning up until this turning point?
Well, I found an interesting thing about Voyager. Watching this episode again, I remembered how much I love the characters. They're really well drawn. I mean, compared to the first season of Next Gen, even the second season of Next Gen, the characters are already, even the first season, they know who they are, they know what they're doing. They're just not given much to do. I mean, you get the Kazon as the enemies, and nothing happens with that. They do a sort of thing with Kes and Neelix trying to guide them through, but that gets dropped real quickly when they get outside there. So there's just sort of wandering for a while. And it's weird that this is sort of like Enterprise, where the start of the Federation and the Romulan War are like the things everyone cares about. and you send a Federation ship to the Delta Quadrant, and then you don't talk about the Borg, or you don't make them a big storyline for a long time. Like, they don't even touch the Borg. They had the one episode, well, it was early in season 3, right? Unity.
Yeah. Yes.
And that does get referenced here. And that sort of aired around the same time that First Contact was in theaters, I believe.
Just after.
And so, right. So you're watching First Contact, you watch Voyager, oh, Borg, and then it's dropped for the rest of the season. And even the writers weren't even thinking about it. They were planning on doing Year of Hell to finish out season 3. And then that got dropped to do this, which I think is a huge improvement. But yeah, I did want to hear your guys' ideas of seasons 1 through 3. My sense of it is the characters, really good. Now give them something interesting to do, please.
Yeah. What about you, Charlotte?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that assessment. There was potential for ideas, and then they just kind of, like you said, dropped them. And then they fiddled around with the Kazon way too much. Chris, yeah. I believe you call them the poor man's Klingon. Is that correct?
I call them the poor man's Klingon, and Larry Nemechek said they used to call them the junkyard Klingons.
Yeah.
They played around with that, I think, far too long. And then, yeah, they're just not really quite sure what to do with these guys. And so then now they finally do involve the Borg. And so it's like, okay, we're going to go with this now. And they roll with it. And then we have seasons 4 through 7, which are a drastic shift from seasons 1 and 3 of the show.
Certainly.
Yeah, that's kind of my feeling. From when the series started, I mean, the concept was internal conflict between the Federation crew and the Maquis. And that was abandoned just almost right off the bat. I mean, how many episodes does that last?
Like 2 or 3?
I don't know, nothing, you know?
Yeah, I missed the first, when this first aired, my family missed the first maybe 10 episodes.
So you didn't even know.
And I realized going back, they did a couple episodes, but when I came into the show, yeah, they'd already moved past that. Yeah. We were like, we didn't even understand that there were Maquis. We thought they were just all Federation.
Yeah. They did, but they didn't. They had that sort of thing with Michael Jonas being the traitor, transmitting information to Seska and the Kazon for a little while. But aside from that, I mean, yeah, everybody was just getting along just fine. It was smooth sailing.
Yeah.
But even that was so fast.
Yeah, but even that was silly. I mean, it wasn't internal conflict. The internal conflict was what we get a little bit in Scorpion is we finally see Janeway and Chakotay disagreeing with one another about something that's very important for the crew. And that was part of the promise of Voyager from the beginning that was just abandoned. But we'll talk about that a little more when we get more into Scorpion, because I do want to talk about that a lot. In terms of leading up to this, you know, you have a lot of, I always felt with Voyager that, well, like Larry has said before, you know, each series is reactionary to the series before it. So The Next Generation tried to separate itself from the original series, but it still maintained the episodic format of the original series. Then DS9 was a reaction to the kind of squeaky clean nature of The Next Generation, and it was darker, and it became much more involved. Mm-hmm. And then Voyager, I felt like, well, we're trying to kind of go back. Janeway is a bit more like Kirk in a way than we had seen in the past. The stories are very episodic again, and you see things like Time and Again and The Cloud or Ex Post Facto, things like this in the early season, first season, that are very much like TNG style, these individual stories, and there's not very much that goes over. And also they kind of, as we get into the Borg when we talk about Scorpion, because Greg, you said that you're kind of surprised that it took them so long to get to the Borg.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I felt like, If the concept is we have to throw the ship all the way across the galaxy to get away from everything that's familiar, but then in Eye of the Needle, we have a Romulan coming on the ship. Okay. Well, why so quickly we're going back to a Romulan here? Just, I kind of felt like they had a concept and they didn't really quite know what to do with it. And they were not brave enough, like the DS9 writers were, to buck the trend. It's probably because it was on UPN and you have studio executives saying, you can't do this and you can't do this and you can't do this, because if they could have, they could have really had that internal conflict with the Maquis. Janeway and Chakotay could have been butting heads more. you wouldn't have had these really, really vanilla characters like Kes on the show for so long.
What I would have liked to see from seasons one and two would be more what Enterprise did with seasons one and two, and more like the original series, where it was just, let's tell a brand new story. Let's show them doing something really special and new. And it's difficult with Voyager because they're just trying to get home.
Yeah.
And it's very different from the let's fly away from. And so you have this always drawing home. So it's harder to just sit here and explore. I keep wanting to call it my favorite episode, but Strange New World on Enterprise is just really fantastic because of that sense of
it's new.
An M-class world that we're just setting down on, and we're just going to see what it's like, and we're just going to have fun and explore.
And Porthos runs out on the field, right? That's cool.
Great. So good. And Voyager never really gets a chance to do that. And I think part of it's the writers, they didn't have those serious SF writers like TOS had, where they could just do, you know, like Squire of Gothos. They could have done that sort of episode on Voyager and gotten away with it, I think.
Yeah.
Because you're so far away from the Alpha Quadrant. Let's see some like crazy stuff. Let's see a huge empire of people that they have to deal with. And let's do, you know, 10 episodes.
They always encounter small planets and docile races. Or you've got the Kazon who chase them for far, far too long for their technology.
Yes.
Right.
You know, this actual same Kazon people.
Yeah.
You know,
chasing them. Yeah.
You don't see that kind of grandiose. They don't encounter like a Klingon Empire or a Romulan Empire or anything like that.
It wouldn't be great if they happened upon the Delta Quadrant, like legitimate Romulan Klingon war.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the Delta Quadrant equivalent, not the junkyard equivalent, but the actual like them.
Yeah.
At war, and Voyager's caught in the middle, and it's something you couldn't see because, you know, in the Alpha Quadrant, the lines are clearly drawn and the Federation is there policing. You know, this is, sure, the Wild West, but there's still going to be strong people out there making a name for themselves, fighting wars, doing plenty of things that Voyager can get caught up in and not know what to do.
Right.
Yeah, that would have been fantastic. Why couldn't they have done that?
To be honest, we kind of get to that with Scorpion, where we have 8472 versus
kind
the Borg.
And you get a...
Finally, we're doing that.
You get a little of it. Yeah, in Year of Hail, which is after Scorpion, you get a little bit of that as well.
Definitely
but,
that.
But still, it's part of the problem of the concept is that you're always traveling away from everything.
Right.
I mean, even in the Alpha Quadrant, I think it might have been hard for them to do... But yeah, there's a conflict between, you know, the Bajorans and the Cardassians, or the Klingons don't like the Romulans or what have you. And but if you're always flying away from it, then
and you know, they always said about DS9 that they worried about things becoming stagnant because you're always in the same place. But at the same time, that allows you to develop some of these relationships.
That's how you build a rich universe and a rich story.
Exactly,
you're always flying away.
Right.
Yeah, this thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, why don't we jump forward to Scorpion itself now? And Charlene, what was your first impression of Scorpion? Now, I always ask this. Did you see Scorpion in first run, or did you see it like on DVD later on?
No, I did watch it during its first run. And I have to say, watching part one was fantastic. I mean, I have to relate this... without actually having the experience, but when people were watching The Best of Both Worlds Part 1 for TNG, I did not watch that on its first run. It was just a tad bit before my time. But then that was the longest summer ever. You know, I'm like, I gotta know what's gonna happen. And the waiting. And I can't tell you how many times I watched it because that was back when we had VHS tapes. Wore that thing out. I loved it.
That's...
I even went so far as to write a script on what I thought was going to happen in part two, you know?
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. That's I was all about
interesting it. Interesting that you bring this up because I actually did see TNG all in first run too. And that...
Did you?
That summer, Best of Both Worlds. Now, that was really something. This, for me, it didn't compare because there was not the... I mean, like, you wonder what's going to happen, but it wasn't quite the same because with The Best of Both Worlds, we really thought that Riker may be becoming the lead and that Patrick Stewart may be off the show. And so there was a lot of speculation about that. Here, you knew everyone was going to be back. So,
yeah.
Actually, I don't know because Garrett Wong thought he actually might not be coming back for season four.
Who was that?
Garrett Wong said that he thought...
Well,
He thought he might not be coming back until People Magazine.
That would have been
him.
Tough because if Garrett Wong didn't come back, they were going to have to find somebody else to kill over and over in future
darn
seasons.
People Magazine, so. It's their fault.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Stupid, beautiful people.
Oh, gosh. Anyway.
But no, I do see what you're saying there.
But yeah, this was another one of these great. This was, I think, one of the better cliffhangers, one of the better Star Trek cliffhangers, the series.
I mean, I saw it in first run too, and I was, 11 years old watching it and just blown away, and just, talk with my Trekkie friend the whole summer about 8472, and we were just imagining all this stuff, and it was one of those cases of. That's a whole summer where you can imagine this war going on, this epic war between the Borg and 8472. Fluidic space was this brand new thing. Yeah. And it just added so much to the Voyager, the Voyager myth. And two, it added a lot to who the Borg were.
Oh, definitely.
Because suddenly we're seeing them, they're not just this unstoppable force. Suddenly they came up against something they couldn't do and they needed. I understand some people found that weakening of the Borg, but what I see is that adds depth to the Borg. Yeah. It sees them as not just the personification of evil, but as an actual thinking force that sometimes needs our help. And sometimes we have to make a deal with the devil. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that for sure. Well, you bring that up. And like you said in Unity earlier in season 3, mm-hmm. See, that was the point where I wrote an article a few months ago that's on Trek FM. It's about the assimilation of Star Trek Voyager, the series itself, by the Borg. And one thing that I saw when they first started introducing the Borg here is that it did appear like we were going to get this exploration. I think we talked about this on the Ready Room before, Greg, too, maybe when Brian was on one time.
We did.
About how we might get to see more into the Borg and see them developed the way we saw the Cardassians and the Romulans developed on Deep Space Nine. And Unity was kind of a sign, these aren't just the normal Borg anymore. This is something new. And then here, again, in Scorpion, we also see that something new. Of course, where it goes from there is for more discussion, but yeah, that is a good point, though.
Yeah. And then they added the stuff like the nanobots. This was brand new for Star Trek canon.
Yeah, they did that even before Apple did, I think, right? I had an iPod nanobot.
I think they
gave
Apple
the idea. I still
have an
iPod nanobot. Oh,
probably.
Yeah.
I did get injected by nanotubules the first time I walked into an Apple store, and I've never been the same.
You were assimilated.
Like when you go to an opening and when they high-five you and the little things go into your skin and
it
injects those little tiny apples into you. Yeah, yeah.
Yep, then you're done.
Yeah.
You are Apple.
Oh, man.
All right, well, would you guys agree that of these two parts, Scorpion Part 1 and Part 2, I think Part 1, for me, is by far the stronger story.
Absolutely.
In fact, Part 1 is a really, really great story. It's very interesting. There's a lot of really interesting stuff being developed. There's a lot of good character interactions starting up, especially towards the end when we finally get the conflict between Chakotay and Janeway. And then for me, the second part, some of it becomes a little bit much, a little bit silly, personally, I think. The whole, we're going to, Janeway's going to fly around on the Borg cube and we're going to negotiate with the Borg and so forth. I think the first part for me is a lot stronger.
Yeah, I agree with that. Part one is just amazing in every way. The writing, the direction, it's just so sharp on both of those accounts. The acting is superb. And, it just punches from one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, and you're drawn in. I mean, from the very intro, the teaser, where the Borg cube blows up, you wonder who would do that to the Borg.
That's one of the best teasers, I think.
Lures you in like that, and you're sucked in from there. Part two, it gets you through the rest of the story, it gets the job done. But part one, man, that's just, it was fantastic. I think that was Voyager certainly at its best at that point, and one of the best Trek episodes, my top 10.
Yeah, I think the teaser for part one is one of the all-time great teasers for any Star Trek episode, because it's so short too. It's just it just makes you think, oh my god, what's going on? And then they go right into the title.
It's 30 seconds of just whoa, they did that. They went there.
I don't know. I might actually have to disagree with you guys, because I find part one to be just all set up. And I found part two to be the actual really interesting part. Mainly, okay, we introduce Seven of Nine. She doesn't show up until part two. So any of the stuff with her has to be, you know, think of only part two. And I think she does a really good job, Jeri Ryan, of doing the doing the Borg and the stuff she says. If we're talking about this conflict between Janeway and Chakotay, it really comes out in part two because Janeway's injured and Chakotay, and this is the first time I can think of that Chakotay's taken command and then gone against Janeway's like direct wishes.
Yes.
And that's a powerful scene where he brings everyone together into the conference room and basically says, we're going to not do what the captain wants now because I'm the captain.
You know, I'll agree with you in that I tweeted earlier when I was watching it that Scorpion's a very mixed bag for me. That's generally a very good episode. And there's some really great moments. And then there's some stuff that's kind of hard to swallow. And I think in part two is what's really the mixed bag for me. That the part that you're talking about there, Greg, is the really great stuff. That's where the interaction and the conflict between Janeway and Chakotay is really excellent stuff. And but it's mixed in with the whole thing about how they work with the Borg for me is just convoluted. Hmm. And so that's what makes that a bit of a mixed bag for me.
All right. I can see that, I suppose. It just doesn't get in the way of it for me. That I love the conflict, especially knowing where they go with Chakotay and Seven of Nine down the road.
You had to bring the two of them.
But I'm sorry. I like Star Trek Voyager. I like all of it.
But like you said about Jeri Ryan in here, she really does a really excellent job, I think, in part two of this. It must have been so hard for her being thrown in there with that Borg makeup and new to Star Trek and just be thrown in the middle of this big story like that. I thought, she really did a fantastic job.
She did do a superb job, yes. But I do agree with you, Chris, more on the whole thing of, well, for one thing, we actually see Chakotay being a leader, which we haven't seen a whole lot of. And you know what? No. That was refreshing and nice. And, you know, we could actually see the boy could get it done. He did what he thought was right. And so it was kind of a nice little clash just to see what would happen both sides. Janeway had it her way for a little while, then he does it his way for a little while, and then she comes back, they work together again, and then resolve the story to its conclusion.
Here's a question. Do you think with Chakotay, this is a problem for me, they made Chakotay, he's the leader of the Maquis, and Janeway is chasing him, but Chakotay also was an instructor at Starfleet Academy. And I think they crippled themselves a little bit with that whole storyline that Chakotay was a Starfleet guy who had turned
back.
Because Chakotay has a great respect for the chain of command. That he doesn't go against Janeway because he is Starfleet, even if he was with the Maquis. And he respects her as a captain, and so he bites his tongue all the time.
that is true.
He acquiesces to her so much. And I wonder if he had really, truly been like a Maquis guy, not a Starfleet officer, if that would have helped the first three seasons and even onwards of the story being more interesting.
That is possible.
Definitely would have brought out more conflict in that aspect, definitely. Yeah. But it does make sense that Chakotay was a Starfleet guy just because there were many people in Starfleet that sympathized with the Maquis. So I can understand how and why they went in that direction. And yet it would have been interesting to see somebody who had a little bit more of a rebellion, a little less respect for Starfleet, if you would. Yeah. I don't know.
I did want to bring up something about Chakotay in command. People give Lara Roslin from Battlestar Galactica credit for inventing airlocking, where you basically take someone and you put them in an airlock and you say, do what I say or I'm going to throw you out of the ship. Chakotay totally does this in Voyager in 1997. He said, if you don't stop, I'm going to vent the compartment, the entire cargo bay. Actually, I think the whole deck he did, which I thought there were security guards in there. But I guess they
who
got
cares
them
about
out.
Them?
But at any rate, he vents Borg drones into space, which is pretty awesome, I have to say.
Yeah.
He took command.
They did this on The Next Generation as well. They vented,
did they really?
I don't know about Borg drones, but they vented one of the cargo bays. And what isn't there an episode where Geordi and Dr. Crusher, someone, are like hanging on to not fly out?
Oh, wow.
I can't remember.
I don't remember that.
But But no, anyway, Battlestar awesome. Galactica was not the first to airlock
no.
somebody.
I'm gonna have to I'm gonna have to give Chakotay credit for that from now on.
Yeah. Yay, Chakotay.
That's the Chakotay maneuver.
Hey.
Exactly.
And it doesn't involve surrendering or setting the self-destruct.
Yeah, I was waiting. I was waiting when Seven was telling Chakotay to turn the ship around. He said, "I'm not Jean-Luc Picard. I don't turn the ship around. I don't activate the self-destruct."
That's right. He says,
"I vent the
we stop here, this
did.
Far and no farther."
Exactly. Well, that's the new yeah. Jean-Luc.
And then he throws something against the wall, but there's no glass yeah. there, so it's kind of dull. They cut that scene out. Just
yeah, it's good.
Wasn't
it's
exciting
good.
Enough. So,
but I do love. I just want to keep talking about Chakotay here because I know Robert Beltran didn't love his time on the show. You know, there's a few actors who just did not love Star Trek, and okay, but he did a really good job in Scorpion.
He did.
Yeah. I mean, he delivered all of his really silly lines about technobabble. He said really strong, important things about stuff he didn't care about. You know, the actor didn't care about any of the stuff. He delivered it really, really well. That scene between him and Kate Mulgrew when she is about to go in for surgery has to be one of the strongest scenes yeah. in Voyager.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
yeah.
Props to Robert Beltran.
You know, it's
Beltran
the thing about... I think Robert Beltran in general, from all the interviews I've read of him in the past, didn't really care very much about any of the stuff that he was saying on Voyager.
Yeah. I mean,
he seems to be the actor of all the Star Trek actors that I've ever, you know, read interviews with who was the least interested in the work yeah. that he was doing. But yeah. not just Star Trek. He seemed like that about kind of everything that he talked about in acting. But so
it's very possible.
I don't know. Maybe if they had given him more interesting things to do on Voyager, he would have gotten more.
It's possible.
That might have helped, definitely.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of being given them easier, more interesting things to do, the main problem I do have with part two is what they do with Kes, because she basically takes the Troi from TNG season one role of the one who's simply there to get her mind taken over and use her to communicate
yeah, so
with somebody.
I kind of disagree with you on this too a little bit.
It really just annoys me that she had nothing to do. She's either moping around or just, you know, scanning someone with a little tricorder, or she's being taken over.
The thing
over.
Is that, just okay, this was her exit, of course. Okay. But also, right. it wasn't totally out of the blue. And unlike Troi, Kes did not exist on the show just to say things like, "I sense that you're angry, Worf, as you're throwing something against the wall," or, you know, or "Captain. Captain, that guy right there, the one that looks really uncomfortable, he's hiding something, but I'm not quite sure what it is."
Yeah, at least
she wasn't on there for that. And
sorry. Now we're hearing some truth.
Yes, now we're right. hearing some truth. Wink. That's the Troi line, right? So, but with Kes, you know, we were having these kind of unusual things happening with her towards the end of the third season. And then this is how she leaves the show in The Gift as well, that she's...
Right.
So... They kind of played on something that they were developing with this kind of telepathic, which was kind of a new sensation for her too. So she wasn't telepathic all this time. It's like something's changing in her.
That is
And they
true.
Were able to work that into the story. Now, I was walking around today and I was listening to just the audio of Scorpion. Mm-hmm. So I could like really focus on what's being said. And I found it kind of, as I do in all these things where she's like, "Oh yes, I can hear. I've been aware of Species 8472 and I can hear them." And Captain's like, "Well, what do they say?" And she's, "Well, she said the weak will perish." I'm like, "How do you know what they're saying? They're like making squeaking sounds or something. How do you know what they're saying?" So that was kind of a stretch, you know, but I did think that they were able to take this thing that was happening to her and use it in a way that helped move the story along without it being just... ridiculously out of the blue.
That's true.
It wasn't totally out of the blue.
That's true.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It wasn't like it just happened all of a sudden and she wasn't playing the Troi misstate the obvious. I mean, it did have a purpose.
That's
it
true.
Wasn't the most interesting part of the story, though. I'll agree with that. And so, you know.
Yeah. Because, I mean, the whole thing about her seeing the Borg, like the pile of molded Borg, which... Charlene, I think
oh,
you
I
say
love
you want
that.
To have that.
Action figures.
You want that for your living room, right? You're gonna
that
put
is
it in the
just the most awesome, creepiest sculpture ever. I want to have it like right in the middle of my living room so that when I invite people over, it is the best conversation piece ever.
Wow. You could put, like,
it says a lot for the action figures from the 90s that they were able to I mean, they painted them, but they chopped up action figures and made that thing.
For me,
it's so awesome.
Amazing. Well,
for me, that's what it looks like, though. It's a little bit, like, it doesn't look real, like real born to me. It looks like someone took a bunch of action figures and melted them together and did a close-up. So for me, it was kind of, it's creepy, and it worked. I mean, it made its point in the story, but I thought it was one of the weaker visuals in the episode. But if you get it for your living room and you could put like cup holders and like a nacho dish on there, it'll be perfect for the Super Bowl, especially if like a creepy team like the Ravens are playing in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
What if it like Raiders versus Ravens? That's not possible. They're both the same conference. But but anyway, yeah, get some creepy teams in there, and yeah, that would be great.
That would be pretty
great
awesome.
Prop. Yeah.
Well, but the pilot.
Oh yeah, we're talking about actual figures. Story, aren't we? Okay. All
right. The pile of action figures is one of the strong visual elements that they were trying to get into Voyager at this time. And it also fed into the visual effects, where there are some really amazing computer generated shots. The one they mainly talk about is, I guess it's part one, where it's just the 15 Borg cubes rushing past Voyager and sort of sweeping it along. That's amazing. Yeah. So many ships. I mean, in part two, you see all of these bio ships. Yeah. It's amazing what they were doing. I mean, compare it to First Contact, the beginning of First Contact, and it's comparable.
Yeah.
You know, considering it's on a TV budget, it's really impressive what they were able to do.
The effects may not have held up on a big screen. You know, like, they're not movie quality. But for Star Trek at that time, I mean, they were. This episode has some really great visual effects. The part where the 15 Borg cubes go by, and they, for me with Voyager, though, it's going like this, you know, like wobbling back.
Yeah,
it's like Tom pulled up the emergency brake, and the ship is like coming to, it's like, you always wonder, like, if you're going down the highway at 70 miles per hour and you yank the emergency brake, what happens to your car? This is like, you're going warp 5 and you yank the emergency brake. This is what happens to a starship.
Right. Yeah, totally. Yeah, Tom Paris, that's about all he did in this episode, isn't it? He pulled the emergency brake once.
Yeah.
They did not give Robbie Duncan McNeil much to do at all, which is crazy considering later on he's like the main character of the show.
Yeah, later on.
Season 7.
He had surprisingly little to do in this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. All right, well, so the turning point here is, of course, the introduction of Borg, the introduction of Seven of Nine, a little bit of a change in the nature of the relationship with Chakotay and Janeway. Why don't we talk about the Borg themselves just a little bit here and how they play into Voyager moving forward? Because the reason I wrote the article, The Assimilation of Star Trek Voyager, is that there is a perception that after this, and increasingly towards the end, that the series should be called Star Trek Borg. It just feels like there's Borg, you know, popping up everywhere and everywhere. And yet, here it makes perfect sense. And it does make sense that they would meet the Borg in the Delta Quadrant, because it was established. This is one of the great moments where they do refer back into the larger Star Trek, that we know the Borg are from the Delta Quadrant. And if they had never encountered the Borg, I think we would be sitting here now saying, I can't believe they flew through the Delta Quadrant and they never met the Borg.
Right, absolutely.
So. Yeah, Jerry Taylor's magic bag of hindsight.
That's right. That's right. So what are your thoughts on the Borg coming into Voyager and what they did with them from here on out? How much did they influence the show? And was it too much? And big thing for me too is what we saw like in Unity and here, did they fulfill the promise that we were going to learn more about the Borg, or did they just become these big bad cardboard cutouts that you pull out every time it's sweeps week?
I'd say it's both. We did learn more about the Borg, and I also think they went overboard on using the Borg, especially for those big two-part episodes. And then, of course, an Endgame ending the show, I thought, oh, brother. Well, let's not get into that one. That's another discussion entirely.
Yeah, it is, really.
And especially with having a former Borg character now on the show, I can see how a lot of people would say it's Star Trek Borg. I mean, once they went there, they ran with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I tell people that give me the Star Trek Borg thing. I mentioned the article you wrote, Chris, and I tell them there aren't that many Borg episodes, like like real episodes about the Borg. But then people tell me, well, but Seven's there and yeah, there's the Borg children.
That, yeah, and I don't count the Borg children.
Really?
Anymore.
You don't?
No.
I
don't count that I will, as the Borg taking over the ship.
Right. Right. I don't like the Borg children. I wish that it never happened. I don't consider it canon, you know, like
it never
the third
happened.
Season of TOS.
Yeah, never that just like the third season of TOS, it never happened.
But I think Seven of Nine brings a really needed element to the show. They needed to bring out a new character. Yeah. I mean, that they just needed it. They didn't have, I don't know, there was that Spock character, that Data character. They had it in the Doctor, but there wasn't what they really needed to give Janeway something interesting to do, to give there that new dynamic on the ship. So bringing Seven on the show, I think, was a good decision. So I don't consider her inclusion something that made the show Borg.
Yeah, neither do I.
Now, if you don't like the Seven character, that's a whole other discussion
to be had. Yeah, definitely.
So like, about the Borg, I mean, the occurrences. So these are the real numbers here. Okay, again, excluding Seven of Nine, because I don't include her as she's Borg. And well, what I did say in there is that because she's on the show and she has her alcove and they put Borg armor on the ship and all, there's this feeling that the Borg are always there. But they're actually, the Borg appear in 22 episodes of Voyager. That's out of 168 episodes. It's only 22 episodes. And not even all of those are true Borg stories, but they have Borg in them. And the Borg appeared in 6 episodes of The Next Generation and out of 176 episodes. And you can kind of contrast that. Like, if I asked you, do you think that The Next Generation was a Klingon series? And I would say no, if you ask me that question. But the Klingons appeared in 31 episodes of The Next Generation. And they also appeared in 49 episodes of Deep Space Nine. But yet, you don't think of Deep Space Nine as a Klingon series, even through the Dominion War, where the Klingons are around all the time. Because there's so much more going on, I guess.
Well, and let's say that season 5 of Enterprise was the Romulan War. I don't think anyone would have complained. Like, oh, it's now Star Trek Romulan.
Right.
Like, why is that a problem? Like, as long as they're good episodes, as long as they're interesting episodes, I don't see what the problem is with there being
Borg.
Well,
they couldn't do that anyway, because in season 5, we were going to make T'Pol half Romulan, and we were going to make Porthos was actually going to be half feline in season 5. It was a new twist we were going to put in, and we're digging into Manny Koto's magic bag of hindsight again.
Dr. Phlox was going to be replaced by a Glommer.
Oh, yeah. Got to give that nod
to
the
anime series
there. This is what we do on the Ready Room, Charlene. We dig in. Anytime we talk about Enterprise, we dig into Manny Koto's magic bag of hindsight.
Good to know. Good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
And I do know that you love Enterprise, so...
We do love Enterprise.
We do,
actually.
Yes. Really.
Okay, so the Borg... Okay, Borg children. So, Charlene, you seem to disagree a little bit with us here when we said we don't like the Borg children. What was your feeling on the Borg children?
Ambivalence. I didn't mind them, and yet...
Okay.
I could take it or leave it. You know, Icheb was all right. The rest of it, though?
Yeah.
No.
It was kind of like became Star Trek Full House for a while.
That would have been pretty horrible.
Icheb was kind of like a Borg Wesley Crusher, and not in the good way, where Wesley Crusher gets assimilated at the beginning of TNG, which would have been awesome. But he's around all the time, and he's whiny. Yeah. Ah,
it would have been cool if they had a Borg Ensign Leffler on, and then Icheb and the Borgified Ensign Leffler could, you know, have drinks in Felix's kitchen or something.
I don't know. Fine. I didn't think Icheb was too bad. But I mean...
Just the concept to me, it was kind of like, we don't need this. You know, there are so many other things that you can do that we kind
of...
We have Seven of Nine to do that thing where the Borg person is trying to become a human person. We don't need to see that in children. We don't need to see there be like a Borg family dynamic. Why?
That's true. And we also don't need Seven to be a babysitter.
Yeah, what kind of homework do Borg kids do? I mean, do they, like, they have, like, quizzes on assimilation, things like that?
Right.
Like, name your species. It's like, quick, Tellarites, What's their species number?
I imagine it's like the testing that Spock did in Star Trek IV. You know, he's on three different screens at the same time. Only multiply that by maybe 10. And you do that every day for the first 18 years of your life until you amass as much knowledge as you possibly can.
And the answer to every question is a number of some sort, right?
It must be, yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, you can always just say, you know, that question is irrelevant. And then they'll accept
that's
that
true.
And move
on. You can always ace. Yeah. In Borg school, you can ace any test by just saying the question is irrelevant.
That's teaching. Great.
Calculus is irrelevant.
Yeah. Learning is futile.
I would now I want to go to Borg school.
Oh, yeah. It's really easy.
Yeah. Pass with flying colors. Get a PhD in that.
Yeah. Plus, if your teacher won't let you leave class to go to the bathroom, you just assimilate her. Again, I mean, she's already assimilated, so I don't know.
I don't think that works.
Could you double assimilate somebody? Like, if you assimilate someone who's already assimilated, do they become unassimilated? Do they just vanish?
We need to get that double rainbow guy in here. Like,
what does it mean?
Double assimilation.
And now we're ready for final assimilation. And today's question is, how much Borg armor does it take
irrelevant
to keep a scorpion from killing a fox? Right. How much Borg armor must a fox have to withstand the sting of a scorpion as it swims across a river made of the tears of Voyager fans?
I think we've gone down a rat hole into fluidic
yes,
space.
Yes, we have. So speaking of fluidic space, why don't we move on? Because introducing the Borg here, it was all great, but to be honest with you, what I would have rather seen on Voyager moving forward was we meet the Borg, we get Seven of Nine, who I think is a very good character that was needed for the show, who creates a great dynamic with Janeway, which was really needed because Chakotay was not able to deliver that dynamic. But Species 8472, for me, is the real promise here that could have introduced a very interesting new villain to Star Trek that was even more powerful than the Borg, but very different. It wasn't just yet another one of these big zombie kind of villains here. And then, I mean, again, it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, we see them again.
Right.
We see them in Prey, and then we see them in the Flesh, which is a really good episode where they're like pretending to be human, right? That's the one where they like simulate.
Yes.
That was cool.
Academy, yeah,
right?
That was cool.
I mean, that was going somewhere. It's like they have plans.
Yeah. Valerie Archer.
They have designs on the Milky Way galaxy Delta Quadrant and Alpha Quadrant and all. And then we never see them again, except for we see them like in a holo photo later on in like someone to watch over me or something like that. They don't go anywhere with that. But I would have liked to have seen them develop Species 8472 over the course of the series.
Right.
Maybe we have Voyager. I mean, maybe we have Borg all the way through season 4, but then they leave Borg space, and then there's some, because this species is in fluidic space, they can kind of just go anywhere, I would imagine, just pop in anywhere.
Well, I feel like what they did with the gift sort of handicapped them, or if I remember correctly from my cheating on Memory Alpha earlier, I think what happened with the gift was they wanted to do something when she left the ship, and they sort of last minute realized, oh, let's have her push them past Borg space.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I think if they hadn't done that and they just sat down and said, you know what? Let's make season 4 be Borg. And then season 5, we can move on. Then maybe we could have seen more of 8472. They would have come back. They would have had to fight them. There could have been more interesting things that could happen with the
Borg. But this is the big problem, like you said, because that does happen. The gift is she pushes them past Borg space, right?
But why
are there Borg in every remaining season of the show over and over? I know the Borg can travel anywhere in the galaxy through the transwarp conduits. I get that. But that's not what we get. We get it's always like they're always like the whole Delta Quadrant is swarming with Borg.
Right.
But yet, Kes
I mean,
is
why weren't Borg in seasons 1 through 1 and 2? Like if they're just spread all over the place, why do they suddenly reach Borg space? There's Borg everywhere. And then afterwards, there's still plenty of Borg.
They like to eat. Like if a Borg eats a sandwich, the Borg eats the middle of the sandwich first and eats out towards the edges and the crust.
That may, okay.
So they hadn't gotten right to the edge of the galaxy yet out there. So as they move towards the middle on their way home, then they enter Borg space. You know, that's how it works.
No, I think the gift really handicapped them. And it's one of those cases where they didn't, this happened a lot in Voyager, they didn't think the consequences of an episode all the way through.
No, that never happens in, but what are you talking about?
Next you're going to tell me that the next gen movies are about Picard and Data.
Greg, I told you to stop drinking before the show.
I thought you told us that we were supposed to drink before the show.
No, that's only when we talk about Star Trek V.
Exactly.
You have to drink before we talk about Star Trek V.
Anyway, no, I think the gift handicapped them, and I don't understand why Jennifer Leon had to leave the show. They were just starting to actually do some interesting
Did
stuff with her.
Did she want to leave the show, or they kind of kicked her off the show?
I think they just asked
I don't
her.
Think so. I think
Well,
they basically, they didn't have money, is my understanding. They only had money for, whatever, seven people.
Well, what is?
And to bring Jerry Ryan on, they had to drop
someone. I was
going
to say, is that why Jerry's suit is so tight? They didn't have enough money for enough fabric to make it loose, or what?
I wish there was an explanation for the cat suit.
The cast character, though, never contributed very much to the series for me, though. I think if Chakotay had been a strong counterpoint to Janeway, maybe there's room for Kes, but we needed something. The show just, the cast just wasn't interesting enough, I think, in the first few seasons. Yeah. They needed
that's
something more, and that's what Seven was able to deliver.
Yeah.
And it seems like the conference room, where I was talking about the conference room with Chakotay, and Kes is there. And you sort of realize, you know, it's sort of like the weakest link. You know, if there's one person around this conference room that we could drop, it's going to be Kes. Sorry, you're not contributing.
Actually,
you are the weakest
link. I don't
know,
I kind of disagree with the whole weakest link. I think if Harry would have been in the conference room not being eaten alive, he would have been the weakest link. And the only thing that kept Harry from being the one that got the axe was the fact that Garrett Wong was one of the most beautiful people of the year.
Right.
I think there was potential for Kes if they would have been willing to explore it. I think the writers just weren't thinking. I mean, okay, they create this weird species that lives only 9 years. She's rapidly going through her lifespan. That could have created some great dynamics as she ages.
At the end when she gets senile and like she and Neelix fight all the time.
Like if she gets dementia or something, that could have been kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know.
Well, what was the episode? Wasn't it? What was the episode where she aged backwards?
Before and after. Very good episode.
Before and after.
Actually.
That's certainly the best Kes episode and probably one of the best episodes of the series.
Agreed.
I thought the
Kes
best
episode.
One was what? Warlord, where she wears black leather for the whole episode?
Yeah.
Is that not the best episode?
Yeah. Well, this gets into my theory of you've got Jennifer Leanne and Jerry Ryan on the same show. Well, and Roxanne Dawson. And I just don't think that that's too much pretty. That's too many pretty girls for one show. And you have to drop one of them. And unfortunately, she was the one.
That's true.
But no, I think there's plenty of things in Jerry Ryan's Magic Bag of Hindsight that they could have done with Kes in those last three seasons.
Did you say Jerry Ryan's Magic Bag of Hindsight?
Jerry Taylor's. There's two Roberts on Voyager and there's two Jerrys.
I thought it was Jerry Ryan's Magic Bag of Cat Suits.
There were those.
She has that. Well, that's how she carries things with her cat suit. She has a bag of holding, and she just puts everything in there. Yeah. So she obviously she has no pockets.
That's true. She has no pockets.
No.
The phaser is on, like with Velcro or something.
Exactly.
Space Velcro.
Space Velcro. Yeah. Transparent aluminum.
Oh yeah, she has a transparent. It's like Wonder Woman's plane is made out of transparent aluminum, isn't it?
Oh, there you go.
That's how Scotty changed the future and didn't even know it.
This all makes sense.
It all comes together now. You heard it here first.
It does. Well, let's talk about one other element in Scorpion that is the whole Leonardo da Vinci thing going on. What did you guys think about this?
Yeah. Well, I thought it was really interesting, the episode where Janeway actually discovers the secret of Da Vinci's code and actually discovers about the lost never mind. Charlene, please take this away. I'm making a really terrible, terrible joke about something that no one even remembers that book anymore.
That was so 2004.
I remember the episode of. Yeah, I remember on The Simpsons, though, when Lisa Simpson uncovers Da Vinci's Code. Now, that was a good one. Go.
We'll say it was a Simpsons reference and then move on.
All right.
Okay.
Jordan, what did you think of Da Vinci?
You know, to be honest, Janeway's taste in hologram programs or holodeck programs, it kind of baffles me. Like, she first does this weird Victorian hollow novel thing.
The hollow novel.
Da Vinci was definitely an improvement, and I could see how that would be a little more fitting, and yet I was still pretty meh about it.
You know,
I didn't care.
I'm just thinking now, going back to TNG and the Royale, what if Janeway had been aboard that old NASA ship with one of these, not a hollow novel, but the actual same novel, and those aliens had to keep her alive and created an environment like that, and then Worf and Data and Riker beam down into that story. Boy, the Royale would have been a really different story.
That would have
been
crazy.
No casino, no baby needs new shoes. Oh well.
No.
But
I'm trying to remember the episode where they finally where they bring Da Vinci back for the one time.
Yeah.
It's the Concerning Flight.
Yeah, the one time.
Was that a good episode? I don't remember it.
I don't.
It was all in the holodeck.
I don't really remember.
And
I'd
it was
say pretty average. That's just my opinion.
Well,
but the thing about this so the idea was okay. So John Rhys Davies was on Sliders. The TV show Sliders. He left Sliders to take on this recurring role on Star Trek Voyager of Leonardo da Vinci.
Poor dude.
So this was supposed to be an ongoing thing with Leonardo da Vinci was going to become a regular, not regular like he's there all the time character, but recurring character on Voyager.
Right.
I guess he...
Like sort of like they planned to do Sherlock Holmes more on TNG.
Well, I think of it,
and that sort of fell through.
I think of it more like he was going to become to Janeway what Guinan was to Picard on The Next Generation.
Right. Yeah.
But then he's in this episode, and then Concerning Flight, and then we never see him again. And I always felt like John Rhys Davies got really screwed on this. Thank goodness the Lord of the Rings came along for him. You know, a little bit later. But the thing is, you can tell at the beginning of this episode, you've got that fantastic teaser with the Borg cubes being destroyed. And then you've got this really slow, like 5-6-7 minute stretch, which is so obviously setting up Leonardo da Vinci to be a dynamic with Janeway that's going to be developed over time. And it was fine when it was happening, but when you look at it now, you think they could have done something better with the time at the beginning of that episode than what they did with this.
To be honest, I think they should have introduced him earlier than in Scorpion. Had him come back in Scorpion, but established that Janeway was, you know, visiting him on the holodeck. And so then you could still have those interactions where, you know, she comes to him while she's trying so desperately to come up with a plan instead of turn away. And she says, what if I made an appeal to the devil? You know, I love that scene, by the way. That's the one part of the Da Vinci program that I really like. They could have still done that, but that introduction to the Da Vinci storyline idea in Scorpion, especially after that incredible teaser, like you said, so slow and kind of out of place, in my opinion.
But I really did like the conversations that they had, though, in this episode. So I think it would have been a little bit odd. Like, Guinan and Picard worked really well because Guinan was actually had a position on the ship, and Picard could just go there. Having Janeway constantly going into Leonardo da Vinci's workshop would be kind of strange. But John Rhys Davies is a very, very good actor, and this part that he played, the way he played Leonardo da Vinci here, I thought was really great, and it was some of that... You often get this really, really great delivery in Star Trek, And he delivered that way. So I think it would have worked if they didn't go to it too often. I hate that they just kind of completely dropped it. I do think it added something to this episode, though.
It did.
I think the problem is not with Leonardo, and definitely not with John Rhys Davies. What I think the problem is that artistic Janeway is not that interesting.
Yeah.
She's interesting when she's going out there and making stuff happen.
Well, she is a scientist, right?
Yeah, but just the idea of watching her make like a sculpture, like in Leonardo's, you know, she's got like her little corner and she's like working on a sculpture of something or she's drawing. I don't see that being good
TV.
But
think how cool it would have been if like in season 6, she had gone in there and created a mashed potato sculpture of the Borg action figures melted together. I mean,
oh man,
how awesome would that have been?
No.
No, I don't think so.
No, not awesome at all. No.
All right.
But
sorry, Chris. No,
I honestly, what I think happened. Okay, so they tried with the Holo novel. That didn't. Whatever that was. Then they tried with this, and I think what ended up happening was they brought Seven of Nine on, and they realized what they could do with Janeway was give her this person to bounce off of. And Janeway could learn more about how to be a good captain, learn more about herself, not by talking to a hologram, not by talking to the computer, but by talking to an actual person. Yeah. And that's, I do think I like Seven more than I like Jane, more than I like Da Vinci, just because of the way Janeway was able to
That's what you've always told me, Greg, that you don't want to see Leonardo da Vinci in a cat suit, right?
Oh, no. My.
Wow.
Yeah, not I agree a with pretty you visual. That,
oh, man.
But I agree with what you're saying. And that is, again, why okay. I think, you know, when you talk about Seven, a lot of people dismiss Seven because she's in that cat suit and they think she's there to like be the sex symbol of Voyager, when actually she's a very strong character who gives what you're saying, gives that ability for Janeway to interact. Yeah.
Yeah. If we could talk about Seven for just a moment, when, the show was first being run, I'm one of those people that really did hate Seven initially, because I did see her as the eye candy of the show, and I saw that as completely unnecessary, maybe because I am female, and I'm not the target male demographic. And fortunately, they did at least have the good sense to develop her character and turn her into this wonderful, you know, being as she's exploring her humanity, becoming something other than a Borg drone. Thank goodness they did do that.
She has very strong opinions, too.
Right. And if she would have just been the eye candy, well, then I think everybody would have hated her. And then the show really would have bombed. But, you know, it's not Seven that I think a lot of people hate. It's the stupid cat suit. I mean, really, was that necessary? Yeah. What season was it where she wears a Starfleet uniform? I think the episode's called Nothing Human. She looks fantastic in it. Why couldn't she have worn that? Come on.
She does it in Relativity. Is that right, Greg? Where she goes to the future.
It's the one with the future. The
she
future
wears,
ship. Yeah.
She really, wears a uniform there as well. Yeah.
Her in the uniform looks good. Neelix looks good in the uniform too. And they only put him in the uniform once or twice. Yeah, I really agree with you on the cat suit. They sort of did the same thing with Enterprise too. With
it's just what they wear in the future.
She's a really interesting character, but it gets in the way. You know, put her in the blue undies from time and again, but can she wear just a normal outfit for most of the
yes,
time?
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Well,
yes.
What if they had put Seven in a lavender jumpsuit?
So? I don't know.
Like, give her some bun hair. And...
Oh, now I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, so.
Let's put her in one of the skirt uniforms.
Oh, yeah. And give her some pom-poms. Yeah.
Wow. Chris's magic bag of rat holes, I think, is...
It's my magic bag of TNG season 1 references.
Right.
I can keep them in there. They're very well padded because I have my fur in the bottom of the bag with the whips. So I can sometimes, you know, dress up and jump around and hiss at people. And that's cool. My...
And
the last
your Technicolor sweaters as well.
Technicolor sweater. Yeah,
I got my Technicolor sweater too. Wesley let me borrow it. So,
how nice.
All right. This is our clearinghouse for past show titles right here.
Wow.
All right. Well,
how are we going to come up with the new one?
I think it's in here somewhere. Why don't we wrap up here? We're getting close to an hour on our discussion here. So just some final thoughts. Yeah. I know we'll talk about Seven more in a future show because she's definitely an interesting character to talk about and really changed the entire nature of Voyager. So as far as Scorpion and this turning point goes, Greg, what are your final thoughts on this episode?
You know, what I... the lasting elements of Scorpion are, of course, Seven, that we'll talk about later. What I think is the adding of depth to the Borg. I mean, not just how they were shown as being weaker than we thought, but also showing how they assimilate, showing that, you know, their technology can interface with Federation technology and can actually be beneficial to us. And also a big part of it was them realizing what they could do with the computer graphics. You know, some of the shots are still a little shaky. I was telling you earlier, I think they actually rendered some of the stuff at 30 frames per second. Yeah, it looks very, possible. You know, video game. Yeah. And so they were still figuring out how to do it, but they created some amazing visuals, and it led to, wow, some of these episodes we got in seasons 4, 5, and 6, they realized what they could do with visual effects, and I think it allowed them to open up the sort of stories they were able to do, you know, leading the way to Enterprise, which is by far, you know, the space shots, the until the new movie, stuff, yeah. The space shots were the greatest looking Star Trek we've ever seen. So this episode really showed what happens when you give the special effects team a good budget and tell them just to go wild and create some startling grand images.
How about you, Charlene?
Well, as far as Scorpion goes, definitely the launching point for the rest of the series, the direction they take it. I don't know. I'm not sure where I lie yet as to whether I liked the direction before or after. I'm rewatching the series right now just so I kind of have it all fresh in my head now that I'm working with Voyager for Trek FM and all that. And I've got friends who are on both camps. The first run, I actually kind of liked seasons 2 and 3 a little bit, and then 4 and 5 and 6, 7 was a little kind of off and on. I mean, it was up and down for me. The second time, I'm noticing a little bit of a change, and so come back to me on this, actually. As I go through the seasons, or rather continue, maybe my opinions are going to change a little bit this time around. I'm not sure. We'll find out.
Yeah, they usually do. Mine usually do when I go back and rewatch things as well. So, but
we'll need to have a serious changing the wig episode coming up where... when does she change? Is that the gift when it actually changes, or is that later on?
I think it's a little bit after, actually.
Okay, but it is there is a change after this episode, and it there is like the two big parts of Voyager.
You know what my next article is going to be for Trek FM? Janeway's hairstyles. I've got to do it.
Oh, great!
I've got to do it because the hair was such an issue. I mean, poor Kate Mulgrew. One of her worst memories of the show, and she's talked about this at conventions, is just how they fussed over her hair over and over and over, especially at the start. And she just said, "Stop it." You know, she had to put her foot down, and they finally just let her be. And the world didn't end, right? You know, it was fine.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I hear they had the same problem with Porthos on Enterprise. Was just like about to walk off the set because of them fussing over his hair all the time.
Wow. Yeah.
All right. Well, for me on Voyager, I think the series, for the most part, probably became more exciting and more interesting at this point. Although there are a lot of episodes in the early seasons that I really like a lot. You know, I like things like Non Sequitur, you know, very kind of unusual stories, interesting stories like that. There's some good things there. And there are a lot of good stories after this as well. And there are a lot of kind of duds as well. You know, like I never really cared for stories like Workforce, two-parter. No, it just...
Yeah,
we'll talk about that later. Never cared a whole lot about some of those. But there are some really great episodes that come up over the last seasons. And there are some that where I just kind of feel like... It's kind of like TNG, you know, even in the later seasons of TNG, as good as those seasons were, you kind of sometimes have these dud episodes mixed in. It's not like where I think DS9 became consistently strong through its final three seasons.
That's very true.
Like with DS9, there are fewer individual episodes of DS9 that I like compared to individual episodes of Voyager or Next Generation. But as a series, I think it was consistently stronger. And so in that sense, I don't think that this was the same type of turning point that DS9 or TNG had. I think that Voyager is the difference between the first three seasons and the last four, despite the fact this is a turning point, it's not as wide of a difference as it was for DS9 or Next Generation.
It is a big change for Janeway. It may not be a big change for the show itself, but I do feel like Janeway's character changes tremendously due to her interaction with Seven.
And I agree with that.
That's why it's my favorite part of the show.
I agree with that, Well, Greg, it was great to have Charlene on with us this time and really fun to talk about Scorpion and Voyager in general before and after and cat suits and all kinds of stuff that we really didn't maybe plan to talk about going in.
Definitely.
That's what happens when you get halfway assimilated.
Definitely happens. Yeah, I love that we have a Voyager editor now. I can't wait until we get that Porthos editor and she can join us on all of our Porthos-related episodes as well.
Right. Not an Enterprise editor, but a dedicated Porthos editor.
Very important.
I have, you know, inquiries in to some of the best schools of veterinary medicine in the United States right now.
Very good.
Including the hated rival of my alma mater, which is Auburn. But hey, Auburn has a great veterinarian school, so we might be able to find... Even though it pains me to send a message over to the Plains, we might be able to find a great Porthos editor there.
So yeah, whatever it
I'm
takes.
Willing to take a bullet for the show and for the site. So, roll tide.
Indeed. Okay, so we did want to mention that we can be found on Twitter, you know, all the time, tweeting about Star Trek at TrekFM is both of us tweeting.
Yep, very easy username.
Very easy to remember. And if it's Chris, you know, you'll see he'll do dash Chris or dash C, and I'll be dash Greg or dash G.
Right. Those are not like little cowboy legs on the end of my tweets, by the way.
It's not a
little smiley.
Sometimes
I do smiley. Yeah, I do. I like to do smiley faces and things because there's no emotion, you know,
right,
when you're tweeting. But then I'll put dash Chris underneath, and I always look at it and I think, you know, people are going to think it's like a smiling cowboy or something.
It's not
that C means Chris.
We're just trying to make sure you know which of us is which. And if you want to be sure, you know, you can find my personal Twitter account where I tweet about Star Trek and more. I was tweeting about the Wonder Years tonight, which features a,
oh my goodness,
can you say young Robert Picardo? It was early 90s.
Sure, young Robert Picardo.
Anyway, I was tweeting about the Wonder Years earlier tonight. It's Greg Harbin. That's Greg Harb as in boy, IN. And Chris, you can be found on the Twitters as well.
Yep, I'm on the Twitters at C Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And I'm tweeting about all kinds of stuff, especially Japan, science, technology, lots of Apple stuff. And I've been known to tweet about glommers sometimes because that's how I get Greg's attention.
Yes, always.
And while you're all around the interwebs looking for us, you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And we really love to talk to people there if you come over because we have more than 140 characters. And you'll also, over on our website, find a contact page where you can send us a message at trek.fm/contact. And if you prefer to leave us a voicemail, you can call 646-652-TREK. Again, we were going to get 652-GLOMMER, but it was not available because Greg reserved it before I could get to it and he won't let me use it.
That is my personal hotline for all GLOMMER-related inquiries.
That's right. All right. So, Greg's been a... one more thing we need to mention because we forgot to do it in the feature.
Oh.
If you want to follow our new Voyager editor,
yes,
Charlene Schmidt, on Twitter, you can find her at the very easy to remember username. Oh, the profanity! That's right.
That's
fantastic. The profanity. But I promise you that she will be very nice to you.
Yes.
No profanity coming in your way. So go follow her there.
Right.
Okay, Greg, I am going to make my getaway before another rejected plot from Star Trek 4 comes in and some kind of probe tries to suck me up off the earth here.
Yes, Chris, I think it's time to stick it in Jerry Ryan's magic bag of cat suits, because the Ready Room is done.